Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Maaseh. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Maaseh. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Maaseh. Maaseh is the concluding section of the book of Bamidbar. The parsha begins by outlining the 42 stations of the Jewish people on their journey from the land of Egypt to the land of Israel. And there is a lot to be said to reflecting on different stations, different stages in the journey of our lives as we go on to fulfill our destiny. But that is not what I would like to discuss today. Instead, I would like to perhaps give an overview of the book and see how our parsha is a very appropriate conclusion of Bamidbar and an introduction to the next book, the book of Deuteronomy. In Hebrew, we generally refer to the book as Bamidbar, in the desert. And in fact, the essence of our book really has to do with the experiences of the Jewish people as they wander in the desert for 40 years. In a previous podcast, I have referred to a classic commentary, the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who is the Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin in the mid to late 1800s, who in his introduction to the book of Bamidbar goes into a whole discussion of how the rabbis referred to the book, which is Sefer Pekudim, or as we know it in English, the book of Numbers. And this is based on the fact so we have censuses in the book, three in the opening chapters, and one in chapter 26, Parshat Pinchas. And the Netziv notes that the significance of these censuses is that the essence of the book is to show us the transition which occurred in the desert from the generation that left Egypt to the generation which is growing up in the desert and about to enter the land of Israel. And I would like to now combine these two ways of referring to the book, Numbers, Pekudim, and Bamidbar. In chapter 1 of our book, Bamidbar, there is a census of all the males above the age of 20. And they are referred to as Yotzei Tzava, those who go out, and I'll translate this for the moment, in battle. And it seems to be very clear that the reason why we have the census is because we want to now know the number of men, able-bodied men who will actually be ready when the need arises to go and conquer the land of Israel. It is not only just numbering them, but as we find in the continuation of the opening chapters, all the tribes are arranged in a very clear order so that everything is being prepared, everything is being set into motion for the Jewish people to enter the land of Israel. And in fact, in chapter 10, when the cloud gives them the signal and the camp is now beginning to move, there is the feeling that in a very short time, the Jewish people will begin the process of the conquest of the land and eventually taking possession of it. So that the beginning of the book is making the necessary preparations for the entry into the land of Israel. The idea of staying in the desert for any extended time was not part of the original scenario. In theory, we should have stayed in the desert for a year and a half, a year, even 5 months, and that would have been it. So that, in fact, the desert, which is an uninhabitable place, which is not a place where one strikes roots, would have been exactly that for the Jewish people. A place of transition, a place of perhaps organizing ourselves for our ultimate destiny to take possession of the land of Israel. But as we read in chapter 11 onward, in rapid succession, the Jewish people complain, the Jewish people sin, reaching a certain climax in chapters 13 and 14, when they send the spies who come back with a very demoralizing report, who in effect tell the people, it is impossible for us to take possession of the land, to conquer it. There are giants there. There are heavily fortified cities. And the reaction of the people in chapter 14 is to lament their situation, to become very bitter and sarcastic, and to say, why did God bring us out of Egypt to die here, to have our children die here? Let us go back to Egypt. And it's at that point that God's response is, because you refused to take on the challenge of actualizing your destiny, you, the generation that left Egypt, will die in the desert. 40 years you will wander in the desert until a new generation arises, a new generation that does not have the slavery of Egypt embedded in them, a new generation that perhaps can break themselves from the shackles of Egypt and thereby be ready to go and enter the land. And therefore, in chapter 26, we have a new census, a census of the new generation that has grown up in the desert, a new generation that is preparing itself to take possession of the land of Israel. That new census is done according to the families, according to those families who will each be given their portion of the land. And so if I now come to our parsha, the focus of our parsha is not the journeying through the desert, but it is the reflection on the journeying in the desert that then introduces the idea of taking possession of the land. So that our parsha, which concludes the book of Bamidbar, is a very fitting conclusion, where on the one hand, most of the book is talking about the experiences of the desert, the experiences of what we could call a transient reality, a reality of a people in flux. We end the book, and it's not only our parsha, but as I think I've tried to show you already from Parshat Pinchas, chapter 26, we are now looking forward. We are now getting ourselves ready for taking possession of the land. In chapter 34 in our parsha, we are given a very detailed description of the borders of the land of Israel, so that it is very clear where we are going, what is the land of our destiny. I would like to look at a number of verses which actually appear at the end of chapter 33. Verses 51 through 55. God tells Moshe, when the Jewish people are in the plains of Moab, the following. Speak to the Jewish people and say to them, you are about to cross over the Jordan to come to the land of Canaan. And then he says, Vahorashtem et kol yoshvei haaretz, which I will translate as, you will dispossess all of the inhabitants of the land from before you. You will destroy all of their graven images, all of their high places where they worship idols. And then it says in verse 53, once again, "V'horashtem et ha'aretz," which once again I'll translate, you will dispossess the land and you will settle in it, because to you I have given the land to settle. And then it goes on in the next verse to say how we will then divide up the land to each of the tribes according to lots which will be cast. And then the concluding verses, "And if you do not dispossess the inhabitants of the land, those that you leave behind will be thorns in your eyes, will be thistles in your sides. They will distress you. They will cause you trouble in the land where you will be settling. And all which I thought to do to them, I will do to you." These verses are not pleasant, in fact, are disturbing to a modern ear. The idea of dispossessing, what we would call today perhaps population transfer, or even more, genocide of a whole population, right, who are living in this land, in order for us to take possession of it. This is a very serious topic on its own, and that actually is not what I want to focus on now. I'll just make one comment, which will be relevant to what I'm about to say afterwards, that the rationale which is given to dispossessing this people is not that these people should not be here, as much as removing, eradicating the culture which basically is at their core. And that is a culture of idolatry. A culture which potentially could undermine the existence of the Jewish people in the land. I will come back to this idea a little bit later. What I would like to focus on is actually a comment made by Nachmanides on verse 53. Nachmanides quotes Rashi, who says, "And you shall dispossess the land of its inhabitants, drive out the people, v'horashtem," which, by the way, is echoed by another medieval commentary, the Sforno, who says, also, when you eradicate, get rid of the people who are living in the land. The Sforno actually says, when you get rid of the people who are in the land, then you will merit to give this land as a possession to your children. And the Sforno, a 15th century commentary who lived in Italy in the time of the Renaissance, says that the word v'horashtem is not just a question of dispossessing the land of its inhabitants, but ultimately it has to do with transmitting the land to your children. And there's a play on words over here. In order to give it to your children, you have to take it away from those people who are there. And this leads me to Nachmanides' comment, where he, rather than focusing on the negative, focuses on the positive. And I quote, "It is my understanding that this verse is giving us a positive commandment. It is telling those people that they should settle in the land. They should inherit it because it was given to them. They should not loathe, detest the inheritance of God. And it should not enter their minds to go and to conquer the land of Shinar or the land of Ashur or any other land and to settle in it. If in fact it should enter their mind to do so, they will transgress this commandment of God." And this is why the rabbis went to such great lengths, and this is discussed in one of the tractates, Masechet Ketubot, 110b, 111a, why the rabbis go to such great lengths to emphasize the importance of the commandment of living in the land of Israel. And perhaps I will add another comment which Nachmanides made in response to Maimonides. I'm sure everyone knows that Maimonides has a work which is called Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of the Commandments, where he enumerates the 613 commandments. Nachmanides attacks Maimonides and says that there are certain commandments which Maimonides left out, which he didn't list. And one of those commandments, Nachmanides says, the fourth in his list, is that we were commanded to take possession, to inherit the land which God gave our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that we should not leave it, I might even translate this, abandon it, in the hands of any of the other nations, or in desolation. And this is the meaning of the verse, our verse 53, and you shall take possession of the land and dwell in it, settle it, because I have given this land to you as your possession. Nachmanides sees our verse as not emphasizing the negative, drive out the inhabitants, but very much sees it emphasizing the positive. Settle this land. Take possession of this land. And if I would add what Nachmanides says in his commentaries, do not loathe it. Do not look for another land to be the land of your destiny, where you will settle. But this is the land. And there are two explanations which are given why it's this land. One is, this is the inheritance of God. And connected with that, it's what God gave, promised to your ancestors, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And therefore, it is our duty to claim this land. And interestingly, Nachmanides says, it's not just that we should not leave this land in the hands of other nations, but that we should not leave this land desolate. So if I now focus on this explanation of Nachmanides, the thrust of our parsha is to very much highlight to this new generation that has grown up in the desert how the land of Israel is the land of their destiny. Not Egypt, not the desert, not any other place, only the land of Israel. And when I use the language, this is the land of their destiny, Nachmanides uses the term to settle down in this land, lehit yashev, which implies permanence. La reshet, to take possession, which is not only for us to settle down in this land, but to then see this as the land which we will hand down to our children and grandchildren for all eternity. And therefore, Nachmanides sees in this verse the commandment, which is basically saying to the Jewish people, embrace the land of Israel, be wedded to the land of Israel, make the land of Israel your permanent home. I would like to now take this idea and see why this also becomes a very important wrap-up to the book of Bamidbar, introduction to the book of Dvarim, and perhaps even becomes a kind of closure, which takes us back to the very beginning of the Bible. On a certain level, it is possible to see a very interesting analogy between the land of Israel and between the Garden of Eden. And in fact, I think I've alluded to this in a number of previous podcasts. What is the significance of the Garden of Eden? The Garden of Eden is the place where we are supposed to have a very intense I-thou relationship. That is the place of our interacting with God. The tragedy of the Garden of Eden story is that when Adam and Eve are driven out of the garden in response to their sin. They are not just cut off from the garden, but on a certain level, they are cut off from God. They no longer have any direct communication with God. But it's more than that. They're cut off from the tree of life, and one might say, from life itself. Because clearly, once they leave the garden, they now become mortal. If I take the tree of life for a moment as a symbol of immortality, a symbol of connectedness to immortality, that actually becomes reflected in a very interesting way in the end of our parsha. At the end of our parsha, in chapter 35, there is a whole discussion about cities of refuge, Levite cities, which are basically set up to be places of refuge for anyone who kills unintentionally. At the very end of the section, in verses 30 through 34, the Torah wraps up this discussion by saying, if anyone kills intentionally, then they should be put to death on the basis of witnesses. If anyone kills unintentionally, they should run to a city of refuge. Under no circumstances should monetary payment become a substitute for the death penalty or for the city of refuge. And were we to do so, we would in effect be belittling, undermining the prime value that we attach to life. And in the very last verse, chapter 35, verse 34, it says, do not defile the land which you are settling in, which I dwell in, because I am God who is residing among the Jewish people. Which therefore means that the Torah is emphasizing the land of Israel is a place of life. Death, but specifically murder, can in no way be tolerated, can in no way be accepted, because the whole thrust of the land is life. And why? Because it is God, the embodiment of life, that infuses this land with its vitality. And therefore, this is a land where we have to highlight living, first and foremost, the importance of human life. And to make it clear that the taking of human life is not to be tolerated, not to be accepted. On another level, this land is supposed to be a symbol of life. If I now take the words of Nachmanides, don't allow this land, don't abandon this land to be a place of desolation. Our job is to have the land flourish, to make it fruitful. In one of my podcasts, I said it is in a certain way what Ben-Gurion envisioned, although he was preceded 3,000 years by Isaac, to take the desert and make it bloom. That it should not be seen as a barren land, but it should be seen as a land which brings forth fruits, a land which is luxurious in the sense of a land which is abundant, because all of that abundance is seen as being a blessing of God, a blessing of God which promotes life, so that it is our challenge not just to come into this land, take possession of it, but to make it a place which is vital, a place which is exciting, a place which is filled with blessing. If I now take the analogy to the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and in a certain sense, undermined the essence of the garden. And I want to look at two aspects of that, which become extremely important when I take the analogy to the land of Israel. One is the tree of knowledge reflects the desire. Desire, I want that fruit. not only desire, but to be godlike, to be all-powerful. And these are two dangers that ultimately are at odds with the idea of life. Power. Power which makes a human being think, we are God. We can do whatever we want. And we can do whatever we want, which then translates into destroying, into killing. Desire, which is very much connected, which even if it doesn't lead to killing, can lead to self-indulgence, where everything which exists is for my self-gratification, where ultimately it is my interest which I put above any other interest, where ultimately the purpose of the garden is to serve God, to serve creation. The purpose of being in the land of Israel, to serve God, to ultimately serve creation, humanity, to be what we would call a light unto the nations, to not be self-serving. And as I said, the two ideas go together. The more that we are concerned with promoting ourselves, the more that we have this desire to just become more and more gratified, the more that can create within us this desire for power which is corrupting, with power which is destructive. And I would add that it is those ideas which were at the core of idolatry. Ultimately, the problem of idolatry is not a question of mistaken belief, but mistaken belief which then is translated into corrupted practice. Corrupted practice which overemphasizes self-indulgence, self-gratification, and which ultimately then spills over into the destruction of the other. And therefore, it is very important that when in our parsha we actually talk about taking possession of the land, which may involve dispossessing the people who come, who are here, the inhabitants, which may involve killing people, the parsha at the end talks about cities of refuge, which makes it clear that ultimately our raison d'etre in this land is based on creating a society which promotes life, a society which is ultimately dedicated to service. And these become the central themes of the book of Deuteronomy. And I would say these become the central themes which from the beginning in the time of Joshua to the present day are the challenges of the Jewish people. We are now in the midst of the 3 weeks, the period where we mourn the destruction of the first and second temple, and specifically the period from what we could call the breaching of the walls to the ultimate destruction of both the first and second temples. The purpose of this period of mourning is to be a period of self-reflection. And I think especially in a modern context, there are a number of issues which it raises for us. So let me begin with the Ramban. One of the questions that it raises is, how much do we love the land of Israel? How much do we see that this is the land of our destiny? This is where our roots are. This is where our future is. This is the place of permanence, where not only we are to be, but the place which we hand down is our legacy to our children forever. And in that vein, if we can affirm that, then we have to ask ourselves, but towards what end? And the answer has to be towards the end of this being the inheritance of God, of being a framework which is always focused on promoting life, on promoting blessing, on looking always towards the other, whether it be God, whether it be people, whether it be creation, and where we always have to struggle with the temptation of power, of desire, of self-gratification. We have been given a historic opportunity to now reclaim the land of Israel, to now make it into a Garden of Eden, to make it into a light of the nations. There is clearly a gap between the reality and the ideal. There is clearly an issue of those people who do not have that love of the land, who do not have that sense of destiny. And there is also the issue of those people who perhaps do not see the point of the land as being towards a greater goal of promoting life, of promoting spirituality, of bringing blessing to all of those around us, but who are perhaps caught up with their own self-interests. I wish us all that we should be able to rise to the challenge of our day and to perhaps bring about a reality which has been envisioned for more than 3,000 years, but which has unfortunately not been actualized because we have been grasshoppers in our eyes. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.